Look, up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane.
No. It's an out-of-control time variant. We're going to get rid of it. Don't worry about it. Howdy. I'm Jeff Goldsmith, and this is the Q&A. My agenda is simple. Each week, I plan to bring you in-depth insights into the creative process of storytelling. Folks, I got to say, I'm really excited for today's episode because it's been so much fun to watch. Today, we are talking about Loki, episode 1 and episode 2 with the show's creator and head writer, Michael Waldron. And of course, I hope they don't get rid of that time variant because we love Loki. Look, this is just another success from Disney Plus and Marvel because every episode so far has been a pleasure to watch. And it's really been a fun couple of weeks because I'm in a Marvel mood with Black Widow becoming the cover story for Backstory Magazine's upcoming issue 44. So that made this episode fun as well. I decided to talk about episode 1 and 2. That's why we didn't launch this when the series launched, because we had to wait for that second episode to come out. I wanted to give people a little time to watch it. But look, Michael was really cool about what it took to work with his staff to make this cool show. I look forward to a more in-depth interview when the show concludes. But we got a lot of good info in here, so I know you'll dig this episode. And speaking of things to dig, I hope you check out Backstory Magazine over at backstory.net. You could read us on a desktop or laptop or via our iPad app, Backstory. You know, if you've never read us before, you could read our free issue, which happens to be Avengers Endgame. And we have a lot of great stuff in that issue. So I hope you will test drive us and read the free issue at backstory.net or via our iPad app, Backstory. And if you like what you see, I hope you become a subscriber. And if you want to become a subscriber, you could use discount code SAVE5. That will save you $5 off a one-year subscription. You'll get access to any new issues we publish, which right now means our upcoming Black Widow issue, number 44. But you'll also get access to our archive, which has older issues in it. And we're adding new older issues as we have time. So it currently goes from about issue 43 to issue 28. And we're going to keep adding new old issues to the archive. But look, it would really mean a lot to me to have my podcast listeners and my YouTube watchers of all these Zoom casts that we do on the Backstory Magazine YouTube page consider becoming subscribers to Backstory Magazine. That would mean so much to me. So thanks for considering. But now, without any further ado, let's jump right into our interview with head writer and creator Michael Waldron about episodes 1 and 2 of Loki season 1. Okay, here we go. Michael, it's good to see you.
Hey, man. Good to see you.
So, I know we're limited on time, so I'm going to skip your breaking in story. People could look you up. You, Dan Harmon, Rick and Morty, all the good things that you did. But I want to go straight to February of 2019, where you were announced as being hired for this series for Loki. And that would be 2 months before people saw Loki grab the Tesseract in Endgame, which came out in May. Tell us about the first meeting, and did you have to pitch yourself with a take, and how top secret it was? Because, now a few years later, we're definitely into the intricacies of the MCU.
Yeah, of course. It was thrilling. It was very top secret. It felt like the most dangerous job I'd ever went on after. My wife, it probably felt to her like I was suddenly in the CIA, because I was like, I've started talking to Marvel about this project, and when it came time to actually pitch on it, obviously I had to know, how the hell is Loki even a character you can do a story with at this point? And I think this was in probably December 2018. And I vividly remember having a conversation with Kevin Wright, one of the creative producers. I was in a parking garage, which was apt, in Burbank, when he told me, all right, well, here's what happens in Avengers Endgame. And of course, to tell me what happens to Loki in Endgame, he had to tell me that the Avengers do a time heist to try and steal the Infinity Stone. So I'm just sitting there having my mind blown. And I was like, well, even if I don't get the job, that was still the coolest phone call I've ever had.
What do you think got the job? Was there a specific pitch that you gave that really like helped?
I mean, I think they just liked the direction. I tried to just really emphasize that I wanted to tell a new story with this character. That was my pitch, was something totally new. We've seen 10 years of movies with the other version of Loki who got killed by Thanos. And so I had a new take on this version. And you know, I don't know, Marvel, those guys are crazy. Why the hell did they hire me?
That's cool. You know, it's listed as 6 episodes. Was it ever going to be longer than 6 episodes?
6 episodes was always that was always the target. And that was good. That was just the right amount of time to me for where it could feel at times like a long epic movie, but at other times, you know, like the best kind of prestige television. I really liked that number.
I like that Marvel, you know, is taking risk with younger writers. And you know, this is technically the second show that you've been a showrunner on, that you've run, Heels being the first. What's something really important that you've learned as a showrunner for running your room that, you know, even in the case of Loki, that you wish maybe you knew more of, that was like a habit you adapted by the end? You wished you could, you know, hop in a TVA machine and tell yourself at the beginning, just on the functionality of handling, you know, the course of being a showrunner and running a writer's room.
Well, I mean, you know, it's it's the second writer's room I've run on Loki. I was the head writer. I wasn't the showrunner. I was not a showrunner on that show. Sure. But yeah, I was running the writer's room. I think a really valuable thing to know that you can't know until you've seen a project all the way through production, which I've fortunately now gotten to do on Loki, on Doctor Strange, where I was on set, and you know, and then with Heels, which came back, is the writer's room. You know, you're in a lot of ways, you're the first department on, but you are a department. And in time, there's going to be other departments full of geniuses, production design, costume, and everything. We're going to come on. They're going to take this creation, and they're going to have ideas better than maybe what you guys could ever have. And it's easy when you're a writer to get caught up in thinking that what you're putting on the page is the gospel, and the way you're choreographing that action scene is how it has to be. And it's just, you know, you've got to go through production on a big one of these things to understand just how many brilliant minds actually come together to make them, and that you're just one part of the process.
Sure. How many writers do you have on your staff?
We had, counting me, we had 6.
Okay.
It was a great writing staff.
That's awesome. How long would people have to write each scripts? How long would you give them? Obviously you guys broke the show together.
not much time. I mean, it was interesting in this case from a pure writer's room situation, in that I hadn't written the first episode when we started the show. Normally when a writer's room comes together, you've written the pilot.
Right.
World is established. You've refined that with the network, or the studio. They're happy with it and everything. In this case, we were not just having to break and define the pilot, and I was having to write that over the course of the writer's room period, the 20 weeks, but then we were also having to get, you know, workable drafts of the rest of the season as well. Wow. And so our writers, just absolutely workhorses. Alyssa Krasick, who wrote episode 2. I mean, she wrote so many different versions of the episode 2 outline. There's, you could just do a whole run of comics on what that show almost was. Bisha Ali, she I think wrote episode 3, her draft of that, in less than a week.
Wow.
I mean, Tom Kaufman wrote episode 5, and you know, equal amount. He and Eric Martin both took less than a week writing their episodes. The writers were really up to the task because we had to be.
You know, just on a personal question for your own creative writing habits, when you sit down to write, do you give yourself a page count to hit each day, or do you try and work for a certain amount of hours?
I don't even know if it's either one of those. I think it's produce something good. Or produce something that feels like it moved the project forward. Look, if it's a deadline and I'm in deep shit, then I got to write X amount of pages. But you know, some days 18 really shitty pages can be a great day. Some days, 2 pages that you're really, really proud of is a tremendous day. And some days, just walking your dog and just thinking about the thing all day is the best day of writing you could ever have. So it sort of varies depending on where you are in the process.
We're going to get into spoilers in a minute or two for episodes 1 and 2. But before we do, something that has been public is the beloved character already of Miss Minutes. And, you know, exposition is really difficult for writers. And this harkens back to Jurassic Park when, you know, there's the animation to explain the ride. How important was kind of being able to filter some exposition through Miss Minutes about the history of, you know, that universe and the TVA for you guys?
Well, from a storytelling perspective, vital. You know, this is a time travel show, and it's a time travel show, which means a week between each episode, which means 7 days of scrutinizing and picking this shit apart. So our logic, it had to be out there and it had to be airtight. And so, yeah, we wanted to communicate it in a way that would be entertaining for the audience. The truth is, I also just think that's how it would work in the TVA. They would need to inform the people they'd taken in about what they do and how they do it. And that's the most sort of disarming way you could think to do that. So Miss Minutes was helpful for us in the same way that she is helpful for the TVA.
You know, representation is important. So is visibility. I thought it was really nice that for Pride Month, you know, it on the document for processing Loki under sexuality, it says fluid. And I think that was really nice for people in the LGBTQ+ community to be able to see. It was just a little touch. When did you guys decide to do that? Because I thought it was cool.
You know, all that stuff is obviously very important. And with Loki, probably, you know, more than any other character, he represents so much to so many people that feel underrepresented, that are fans of the MCU. So all that stuff is really important to the whole creative team. You know, I think moving forward with it, I look forward to people just experiencing that within the show dramatically and seeing, you know, the way that story is shared.
I look forward to it as well. All right, we're going to get into the spoilers. If you have not seen episode 1 or 2, we're going to be discussing them. So please press pause, go into Disney+ and watch episode 1 and 2 of Loki. You know, just going for the pilot here, there's so much ground to cover. And you did such a fantastic job. But the question that have been on fans' minds ever since Endgame is, where does he go when he picks up the Tesseract? And so of all the places to go, like an abandoned countryside in Mongolia was definitely an interesting choice and not where people thought it was going to be. What were some of the variants that you played with before you arrived there?
You know, I think either way, we wanted to send him somewhere totally unexpected and somewhere that he couldn't, you know, somewhere that felt to Loki like the middle of nowhere, like right, the opposite of New York City. There was once upon a time, I think he landed on another planet surrounded by aliens that were like capybaras. That was a pitch from Jess Dweck, one of our writers, and that lived so long that we actually had a stuffed capybara in our writer's room. But ultimately we felt it'd be more compelling if he stayed earthbound. And then I think it was Kate who, you know, steered us toward Mongolia and that desert as where he should go.
I love hearing about those kind of discarded left turns and early ideas. And it's funny to hear that you had a stuffed, you know, animal like in your writer's room because you guys were so sure it was going to go that way. Was there anything else in your pilot that was an idea that you really were beholden to for a long time that you eventually discarded because you realized it didn't fit, was going to be too expensive, too time consuming?
You know, there's so many. I can say most all of the ideas that we really loved, if they didn't make it into the show exactly how we initially conceived them, they made it in some other way, except for one. And that was once upon a time, Loki in his run through the TVA, he had the aid of a kind of a sentient floating platform, which there's a bunch of those in the TVA comics. That was an idea that I really liked that didn't really make it off the runway, but did become a nice running joke among the creative team.
And what was its purpose exactly?
It's just a floating platform.
Get around. Yeah, makes sense. A hoverboard, if you will. Well, so, you know, look, I think that redemption is important. And what's really fascinating about the pilot is that we're seeing the version of Loki that was taken, right? So he hadn't had that character arc that we see him take, you know, in Thor Ragnarok, especially where he's, you know, doing the right thing and he's joined with his brother. So he has a lot of distance to go. And I thought it was fascinating the way that you used the device to show him his future, the rest of his file. Love the fact that it was on 35 millimeter too, but you know, it was interesting to see that, you know, he was arbitrarily causing his mother's death, and also that Thanos kills him, and that, you know, he was fighting the good fight and he has a long way to go. And we've seen things like that going back to Twilight Zone or even Albert Brooks's Defending Your Life, this file of your life. When did you get that idea and use it as a way to remind the audience of how far Loki has to go as a character, which I'm assuming we get to see in this show, because it'll be refreshing again to see him go on that character arc, if he does, of actually doing the right thing rather than just kind of being the god of mischief and always a bad guy.
On day one of the writer's room, we really planted a flag that we wanted Loki to see how his life was supposed to play out. We wanted to be able to bring this version of Loki up to speed, you know, and sort of like put him on a level playing field with the other version of himself and see what that guy had experienced it in part. So maybe he could reject all of those lessons. We referenced again on day one, printed out a picture of Buzz Lightyear in Toy Story. When Buzz finally realizes and comes to grips with the fact that you are just a toy. You thought you were in control of all these moments in your life. You thought you were the guy running the show, but no, it was us. And that was a really compelling way of bringing Loki to his lowest point at the end of the first episode, and to really launch him into what I hope is a totally new character story over the course of this series.
Well, it was interesting at the end of the first episode, because like there was the setup that they were tracking a dangerous variant. And at the end of the first episode, you as a cliffhanger say that the dangerous variant we're looking for is you, which is a very time travel setup. At what point did you realize that that was going to be your cliffhanger for the end of the pilot? Because it's just a great way to stop.
I think again, early on, for sure, that was a Kevin Feige thing. He always latched on to that would be the most thrilling end thing to go out of the first episode on, and I think he was right. So I was, even in my first draft, I believe I was writing toward that.
Getting into episode two, finding a place to hide out. That was just a great sequence where we see that Loki learns about Ragnarok and what happened and doesn't really even understand it, obviously, the way that we would, because it's just one sheet of paper. This concept of hiding out in an apocalyptic place and going to Pompeii was great. And it's been done in other time travel before, but it was just a great choice for this. At what point did that come about?
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't want to say too much about episode two, except just that was one of the big sci-fi ideas that we really sank our teeth into. You know, what where could you hide from the TVA within the rules and the laws that we'd established, and coming up with that felt like a big breakthrough. And you know, we gave ourselves a nice pat on the back that day, and then it just becomes a really interesting series setting to go to.
I mean, it was perfect. And then again at the finale of episode two, you know, you again pull the carpet out from the audience, in which you learn that it wasn't Loki that they're actually chasing, but a female who is yet unnamed, but, you know, fans might recognize possibly as Leah. And so that misdirection of episode one to yet again changing the game in episode two, was that something that as you were kind of doing your show Bible, you realized would be another way to just keep fans engaged week to week so that they almost feel like Loki, in which they're just not sure what's going to happen next?
It's something I carried with me from Rick and Morty was just a sense of accelerated storytelling. That doesn't mean moving too fast, I hope. It still means taking time for the quiet, slower scenes, but keep your story driving forward. Answer questions in some cases as quickly as you ask them. That's the stuff that I think thrills an audience. And so every episode, we would sort of say, all right, this should be the best episode of this show. And so we were just trying to blow everybody away and reshuffle the deck every time.
What was your toughest scene from these first two episodes? The one that you really kept sweating over and over and returning to on the page? And how did you creatively rise to the challenge of it?
I think, you know, from just a hours logged, I mean, the scene between Loki and Mobius, the kind of psychoanalysis scene, there was just refining that dialogue, because that is just a pure character study of Loki. But I was never sweating that. That stuff was really fun to write and to do. I think the writer's room really, you know, as you get into more police work, so to speak, in episode two, they really rose to the challenge in helping build all that stuff out.
Was it difficult to kind of balance the drama of the show, but also kind of Loki as a person, kind of like hanging in to fight for himself as a variant that shouldn't be erased? Because it seems like that's also where a lot of your drama would come from in a show like this. The drama of Loki as a character, as a person, as an individual that doesn't want to be erased.
You right.
Know, that has to prove himself.
Right. Yeah. Who are you rooting for? Who are you supposed to be rooting for? Loki's a bad guy. Are the TVA the good guys? The show is called Loki. Is he the hero, or is the TVA the heroes? They say they are.
Right.
I hope that everybody feels a little bit like their head's spinning, because I think that's how Loki feels. And we were trying to craft a story that really puts you in those shoes as you watch it.
And that makes sense. And we have no proof that the TVA is entirely good at this point, only what we've seen. I'm curious what kind of integration you had with the writing staff of WandaVision. I mean, obviously you worked on Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. We know that Wanda is going to be in there. They talk about Nexus a lot in your first episode, and we know that Wanda is a Nexus being. Were you working at all with that writing staff?
Their writer's room was right next door to ours. And so, you know, every day I'd walk by and I'd peek in and see they had so much cool shit on their walls, and I'd be like, oh my God, that show's gonna be so good. We were, if anything, we were like, all right, well, what they're doing over there is so crazy and so weird and interesting. Like that almost freed us to be like, all right, look, guys, like let's take big swings like they are. You know, Jack Schaefer, the head writer of WandaVision, became a pal of mine, and her and I certainly communicated and stuff. And I think that to the extent that creatives within the MCU can be friendly and can sort of, you know, at least be aware of what others are doing, you know, it'll help the universe stay that much more cohesive.
Sure. Well, I absolutely love the show. I can't wait to see the rest of it and look forward to talking to you again as it concludes when you finally are allowed to talk about all the finer details. And look, Michael, congrats on a job well done.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate it.
And that's how the Q&A went down. Special thanks again for Michael Waldron for being so generous with his time. It was fun talking about episodes one and two. You could tell that was possibly one of the first times he was actually publicly discussing spoilers. So it'll be fun when he's a bit more relaxed when the season's over and we hopefully have a wrap-up interview, because you could tell just from those first two seasons, the rug is going to be pulled from under the audience again. Without a doubt, I love the show, so I can't wait to see where it's going. I am in a Marvel mood right now because the next upcoming issue of Backstory Magazine is going to be Black Widow. And we're going to have a lot of great stuff in there for that as well. So if you've never read Backstory Magazine before, please keep in mind that you could read us on a desktop or laptop or via our iPad app, Backstory. If you've never read us, you could test drive us by reading the free issue, which happens to be our Avengers Endgame issue, which you would really enjoy. So you could read that right through our site or through the Backstory app on an iPad as well. And look, there's a lot of cool stuff in there. So if you want to subscribe after reading that free issue, I hope you do, you could use discount code SAVE5. That will save you $5 off a one-year subscription. It'll also give you access to our archive in which we have old issues pop up. We currently go from about issue 43 to 28 in our archive, but we're continuing to add new old issues to it when we have time. So it will continue growing. But look, it would really mean a lot to me to have my YouTube watchers of these Zoom casts on the Backstory Magazine YouTube page, and also my podcast listeners in iTunes and Spotify become subscribers of Backstory Magazine. So thanks so much for considering. The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith podcast is a copyright of Unlikely Films Incorporated in 2021. All rights reserved. Folks, if you want to reach out to me, I'm happy to respond. You could write me at backstoryletters@gmail.com. I'll do my darndest to respond. You could also find me online on social media. You could find me as Yo Goldsmith, both on Twitter and Instagram, Yo Goldsmith. I also run the Backstory_Mag Twitter and Instagram page. So you can find me there. I have a Facebook fan page. I don't use it as often as I probably should, but I will be able to still be reached there as well. And I'm happy to answer what kooky questions you may have. I'm Jeff Goldsmith, the publisher of Backstory Magazine and the host of the Q&A, thanking you for tuning in and telling you to stay out of trouble. Till next week.